Our guest this past week is one of the most influential behind-the-scenes talk radio programming executives of the past quarter century and one of the driving forces in today's conservative media. As a program director, he's served at major stations such as WJR in Detroit and WABC in New York. As a national figure, he served as vice president for news talk programming at ABC Radio, and for the past dozen years has filled a similar position, vice president and director for the spoken word format at the Salem Radio Network and the Salem Media Group. Over the years, he's had a tremendous influence on the careers of dozens of major radio personalities, including Sean Hannity and Mark Levin. Stand by for a fascinating conversation with this major radio industry player discussing his conservative political views, bias in social media, freedom of speech, and the tenets of talk radio. Our guest this week is Phil Boyce. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, the Podcast One app, and Spotify, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with Phil Boyce. When we were testing levels at the beginning of the interview, the conversation became so interesting, I just let the recording continue with no official start.
Even though I am a manager of talk show host, I don't think I would be very good as one.
I'll bet you would.
I found my niche early on.
Yeah, you'd be amazed.
My niche is behind the scenes.
Well, that's an interesting point of view. I've operated my career on both sides, and I got to tell you, I think that a talk show host should be able to talk forever without a commercial break. I think one of the best ways of auditioning somebody, throw them in the studio. Okay, let me hear you talk about stuff. Go for an hour. They go, an hour? I don't have any breaks.
I learned a long time ago that how good is a talk show host when their telephone lines go dead? Mm-hmm. And it's all on them. And it actually happened to Matt Drudge. I had him on Saturday night, and our phones went dead. And I walked by the studio because I happened to be in the city at the time. And he's sitting there with his feet propped up and he's got his fedora hat on and he's just letting it rip. And I'm like, that guy's going to be a talk show host. Of course, he didn't end up keeping that job, but he had the ability. He was that good.
I've heard stories. And by the way, I'm just letting this record go because we're off and running, that what we just said was great.
Okay.
I've heard stories that I think is either Larry King or Barry Farber or both. I've heard stories that guests who have been on their show have had the experience where during the break, the host said to the guest, I got to go out to the bathroom. Just talk. and these are not professional hosts. These are guests. Just talk. And they told me that the one of them said that he was on the air for about 5 or 6 minutes, and one maybe longer. I don't remember the details, but just thinking about that is kind of funny. First of all, it's hard to do for someone that doesn't know how to do it. But secondly, it takes a lot of courage for a host to do that and get away with it. Great story.
Oh, right.
So,
right.
And both
who
of them.
Who was that host who was on, I think, Mutual Williams, I think was his last name. And he used to play a deck of cards like solitaire during the show. So he's taking these calls and he's talking, you know, he's answering people's problems, but he's playing a deck of cards and playing another game in his head at the same time.
That, I think, is Bruce Williams that you're referring to.
Bruce Williams.
Yeah. He also was such a seasoned pro. And I don't know. I think the business was more relaxed in those days. Not to take anything away from the old school. As a matter of fact, the old school has some things that I wish the new school had. But one of the things the old school was different is that a host could come into a news talk show. We'll keep it at that. And
not be prepared. They could just wing it. They, you know, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the studio, or let me tell you what happened with my wife or my kids. Just something off the top of their head. Whereas in today's media, a host has to really be prepared. Have you noticed that change over the years? I mean, you've been programming for years. That's one that I find to be profoundly evident.
Well, true. Talk radio has moved into the political world. You don't have to be a political junkie to be good at talk radio. You just have to be able to be a good storyteller. But you do have to have substance. Listeners have become less forgiving of the funny, cute stories and more interested in learning and discovery. And we learned this from Rush Limbaugh. Rush had this interesting ability to weave a great story and to be very entertaining, but you would always learn something. And listeners are coming to learn. And so if we forget that, we don't last very long.
Jim Rome brought up an interesting thing along those lines at a recent keynote speech he gave at the Talkers Convention. And he said that it's particularly challenging talking to an audience. In his case, it's sports, but it's the same thing in news talk and everything else. It's particularly challenging to talk to an audience that is as informed, perhaps in many cases, more than you are. Whereas, you know, again, in old school radio, you had the AP machine at your command. They didn't. You had, you know, all of that input. You were doing research and all that, and most listeners maybe weren't. But today, you've got these talk radio junkies and these news freaks that have all the access to the same sources that the radio station or the studio has. And that makes it even more demanding. Interesting, huh?
Oh, it is interesting. I remember Hannity telling me he never wanted to have a caller be more informed about a subject than he was. Consequently, he would do reams and reams of show prep. He would sit down in front of that microphone with a stack of papers like 2 inches thick. And the idea was he couldn't possibly have read all of the articles, but he had to have this stuff in front of him at his disposal so that if he got that obscure caller that asked him about something that was in the Wall Street Journal, he could find it immediately and respond to it intelligently. I look at talk show hosts as the Lone Ranger. They have to be willing to stand up there and take on all comers who may have all kinds of different reams of information, and they've got to be able to eat whatever topic that is. Today, we are more in control of the direction of the show, and I never like to see a talk show host let the callers guide the show. You don't let Joe the truck driver get up in the driver's seat and just start driving. You want to control the show. So, it's an interesting mix when you use callers.
It is an interesting mix. And one of the things that I find in my own dabbling with hosting, which I call it dabbling at this point, but it keeps me pretty plugged into what's going on in the trenches, is that you don't know when that caller you've never spoken to calls whether or not they're talking through their hat and they're totally out to lunch, or if they are actually giving you breaking news information that has a great value. And the last thing you want to do is dismiss a caller and throw them away if they're actually the first one telling you something that you don't know and that the audience needs to know, against the downside of giving credence to or giving airtime to something that's nothing but, you know, BS and wrong. That's a very difficult line to walk when you're in spontaneous conversation on the air.
Oh, yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. We never know who we're talking to. We open up the phone lines and anybody in America can get on that line. And we've got to be constantly on our toes and prepared for them to say something that would get us in trouble. You've seen the cancel culture trying to come after us for very minor infractions. Of course, I remember when Bob Grant had his little comment that got him fired. He was talking to Carl of Oyster Bay, who was a frequent caller. Carl of Oyster Bay knew that Bob hated Ron Brown, the Commerce Secretary who had died in the plane crash in Bosnia. So he was goading Bob Grant to say something humorous And Bob finally did. And it was, that's all it took to fire him. So I'm very well aware of how a caller can lead you astray.
I remember how that led to the firing, and you were involved in that. You were giving a Lifetime Achievement Award at another convention. I think it was the R&R convention from, I believe it was WABC at the time. And
yeah.
And then WABC did not rescind their dropping of R&R did somebody R&R did not drop did not rescind the decision to drop giving Grant a Lifetime Achievement Award, and you called me and said, would we let WABC give the award at our convention? And that turned out to be one of the most successful things we ever did. Gosh, that was a while ago. It's hard to believe how much time has gone by.
Oh, man. I had not thought of that until you just mentioned it, but you're right.
Yeah.
We asked you if we could give that award that they took from Bob at the Talkers Convention. You were gracious enough to say yes, and we gave it to him. And it was a memorable experience. I was talking to James Golden today, who's an old friend, and of course he was the former Rush Limbaugh producer for so many years. And he was telling old Bob Grant stories, and the interesting topic came up: was Bob Grant really a racist? And he said, James, who is a black African American, he said, "No, I don't think he was. I knew Bob. I actually produced his show for a while. I don't think there was a racist bone in his body. He just would say things that were controversial, and by today's standards, they would be considered racist. But back then, they were just controversial."
Well, let me say, I'm no fan of racism, and I'm no fan of hate, and I'm no fan of being untrue. So I want to establish that. But I do want to say that, as a defender of the First Amendment for so many years and a protector of talk show hosts of all political stripes during these decades, that I find it very difficult to deal with the fact that many politicians, many media people, many activists from all sides, but it is aimed mostly at conservatives, are very quick to accuse people of hate speech, of hate crimes, of being racist, when in fact they're really not, falling into the definition of racism. They're just criticizing something that might be offensive to certain people of different religions or different races. And it's almost like a dirty weapon to call somebody a racist flippantly or frivolously.
Oh, right.
And I find that to be one of the biggest problems today in our maintaining a healthy balance and use of the First Amendment.
Oh, yeah. And you know why they do it. The left today has to keep stirring the race pot. America is not a racist country. It's probably the least racist country on earth, and yet the race baiters benefit by keeping the races stirred up and against each other. And it was so disappointing to see this happen over and over again under the Trump administration. But you know what? It's probably always going to be this way, and we're just going to have to fight it.
Well, I mean, we're always going to have to deal with these issues because freedom of speech is not a tidy affair. Democracy is not tidy, and the human race is not tidy. I mean, this type of stuff has been going on all the way back to the beginning of conversation. We tend to think that these are the worst days and these are the toughest days and the world is going to pot. I don't remember any time when the world wasn't going to pot. It's just that we're living in the now, so it feels more intense. But you look at history, look at the things that our ancestors, our fathers, our mothers, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, look at the stuff that they've gone through. In some cases, it makes today look like the best times we've ever had in history, in America or the world.
I would push back on you a little bit, Michael, because I think I'm seeing the worst of it now than we've ever seen. And the reason is because the big tech oligarchs are using their platform to silence the other side. That's something we didn't have 20, 25 years ago, back when this stuff was boiling over. It's worse now because big tech is really censoring those that they don't agree with, and those that they don't agree with happen to be on the right. So thank goodness for certain companies that are willing to stand up against that. I think mine is one of them, but there are others, and we have to keep this battle going because we can't lose our freedoms. Our freedom of speech is our most important value.
Within the First Amendment, if these big tech companies were in fact private businesses, they actually have the right to censor, just as Salem Radio has the right to put someone on or someone not on based upon whatever their sensibilities are. However, if in fact their power is so great that it can affect people doing business and people, their livelihood and their means of expression on a level that is fundamental, then perhaps we should be reevaluating what Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and some of these mega giant digital age platforms do, and look at them as public utilities. I'm sure you're aware of, Section 230 and all of that. Do you think that we need to reevaluate how these big companies are categorized because of the tremendous weight that they carry in terms of day to day life, day to day business, day-to-day discourse, and not have them be in the realm of private businesses protected by the First Amendment to censor?
Well, I do agree with you there. I also agree with how you started off by saying what big tech is doing is not against the law. They are a private company, so they can make their choice as to which direction they go to. And I don't want to put a legal restriction on them, just like I don't want them to put a legal restriction on my company. But I do want them to see the damage that they do. One way that we can get out of this mess that we're in this country is through the free, open exchange of ideas. Talk radio is a great place for that to happen. So I don't want anything to happen that would put a restriction on talk radio and its ability to actually do what it does. The warning of the fairness doctrine coming back is always over our heads, and we don't want that. So, no, I don't want to force them to. I want them to see the wisdom of trying to let both sides be exposed and then let the viewer or the reader or the listener decide for him or herself.
I don't think we ever, back in the days when 230 was put into operation and we came into this digital era, and again, you and I have both been active members of the radio community all the way back to the analog era, I don't think we ever imagined how powerful Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Amazon, it's a bit of a different type of category, but it made its bones in the digital age. I don't think we ever thought it would be this big. Isn't it amazing how powerful these companies have been? I mean, they are the U.S. Steels and the General Motors and the General Electrics and the General, all the big companies that we grew up with. These are the new ones. We thought of them as alternative little funny things on the side, but it ain't the case.
Well, they are, and unlike a big steel company or a big car manufacturer, they actually can control thought. Mm. And that's the scary part. If they control thought, they can get in your head and they can push the narrative to a certain place that might not be correct. So I'm worried about that. And I hope that talk radio leads us out of this mess.
Speaking of talk radio, one of the things that talk radio deals with is being a medium, radio in general, and talk radio being a subset of it, a medium that has its roots in the 20th century and has its roots in analog, individual radio station transmitter, FCC license, that paradigm. Now, one of the challenges facing the radio station-centric industry is dealing with digital media. We have podcasting, and we have all kinds of online streaming and all kinds of different platforms that radio stations are faced with competing against and exploiting. Podcasting has become a very big deal. I am proud to say that Talkers Magazine and yours truly were way ahead on that curve. And we were talking about podcasting as far back as the late 90s, when I used to call it stickless broadcasting. I didn't have the word podcasting yet, but stickless, meaning you could broadcast without a stick. And for those listening to this who don't know, those who don't know what a stick is, that's the paradigm of a licensed radio station with a transmitter and a tower, and the tower was the stick. So you're on a big stick. That's the way I got a job on a big stick. So I know it's funny. It's funny language. But you've made some great headway In integrating into the podcast arena with the Salem Radio Network. And I understand that in recent metrics, you're up there in the top 15, maybe even like number 12. I'm not sure how those measurements work. We're all still learning that. But the point is you've made an impact. What are your thoughts about podcasting and how have you dealt with it?
Yeah, I think podcasting is a wave of the future. I don't think it's going to replace talk radio or radio in general. But I think it's a great way to augment what we do. When I joined the Salem Radio Network in January of 2015, we immediately started talking about podcasting, but it didn't seem like the right time. What we needed in order to get into that space was a game changer. We basically needed a big-time podcaster. Well, at the end of last year, we got that big-time podcaster, and that was Charlie Kirk. And Charlie came over to us from Norm Pattis's Podcast One. He had already established himself there, so we had an established top-of-the-line podcaster to build around. Then we added Dinesh D'Souza, who quickly became our strong number two. Since then, we've added others like Todd Starnes. Just yesterday, we announced Trish Regan was going to join our platform. And what I'm finding here is that we are no longer restricted by the beachfront property that we were running out of. When people would come to me and say, I want to be a talk show host, how can you get me on the national stage? I'd say, well, really, I don't know if I can. We've run out of beachfront property. But in the podcasting world, there is no limitation. Your own limitation is your bandwidth. How much bandwidth can you get? And of course, you pay for the bandwidth, so there's a little bit of a cost there. But other than that, you don't have the kind of restrictions that you have on being an over-the-air radio broadcaster. You don't need the stick. You don't need the network. You don't need to go out and find affiliates. You can just put this show on, and if it's good, and if they have a big social media following, which all of these shows I mentioned do, they can get the word out. They have a new episode, and boom, they're in the business of putting that word out to a bunch of people. Just in the last month, Charlie Kirk reached almost 8 million downloads, and Salem in general did 12.5 million downloads. And that's a big number. We just started this thing 6 months ago. We're already top 12, as you said, Michael. And, you know, I don't know where the limit is. The sky is the limit, I guess. And so we'll keep going for it.
Are you monetizing it well? Is it proving lucrative? One of the things you hear is that podcasting is good for a lot of things, but it's hard to make money at it. What are your thoughts about that?
No, we're making money with it. We've got millions of dollars on the books in top-line revenue. I don't know what my bottom line is going to be, but I think it's going to be close to half that, because usually with a lot of the podcast deals we do, we're in 50-50 rev shares. So whatever money we make, we split with our partner, and that means that we have an instant 50% margin. What business can you jump into out of the gate and get a 50% margin? The average, you can ask John Catsimatidis, but the average grocery store has a 2% margin. So it's a very lucrative, profitable business. I was talking to our CFO this week, Evan Mazur, who was talking to an investment banker who had invested in Salem. And he said, you know what? The Salem Podcast Network is the most important, impressive new venture for Salem in years, because it's got all the growth potential and it doesn't have the risk. So we're not out there buying radio stations to put this thing out there. We used to do that. Now we don't have to.
Now, you mentioned a few moments ago, you referred to radio stations, although you didn't say radio stations. You used the term beachfront property, which translates to valuable property that will hold its value because of its geography and its history. Do you feel confident with the advent of podcasting, particularly in some of these other forms of digital media that radio is dabbling in, more than dabbling, investing in, and in some cases being quite successful in, as you point out? Do you think that the position of the stick as being beachfront property is secure, or do you think that we're going to be facing a serious erosion, to use a beach term, due to podcasting and those aforementioned forms of media?
Yeah. Well, we've seen erosion already, and we know it's a tough world that we're living in, but I don't think radio is going to go anywhere, because when you get in the car, you want to turn it on. when you wake up in the morning and your alarm clock goes off, it's usually set to your favorite radio station. But I do think that these digital opportunities that we're talking about, like podcasting and like streaming, is a wave of the future. Many companies are getting into streaming now because there's thousands, millions of people listening on the stream. You can listen on a desktop. You can listen on your iPhone, your iPad. I mean, most of the time, the old transistor radio has been replaced with the iPhone. The iPhone is your new radio. And frankly, the way I listen, and I listen to stations all over the country every day through TuneIn and through iHeartRadio and other means, I listen digitally. So I think there's going to be a future, but it's going to have to include the digital component.
Now, I think, you know, you mentioned you listen digitally. One of the things I find, and a lot of it goes back to this incredible invention called the smartphone, which in my opinion is up there with fire, the wheel, and the refrigerator. I think refrigerators are an amazing invention that we don't give enough credit to in terms of changing life. I think that the smartphone is up there with the wheel and fire and the refrigerator as a game changer in terms of the human experience, the evolution of humanity. I mean, I get a little cosmic on it because I really think it's that heavy a change we're going through. I think our nervous systems are being rewired by all of this, and thus we're changing. That being said, do you think that Nielsen and or other radio rating services are up to the task of mixing the apples and the oranges of analog on-air listening with digital online listening? Because I find that a lot of people don't know that they're listening digitally. They actually think their smartphone is a radio. They're so used to using the smartphone as the way when we were kids, we used a transistor handheld little radio with plugs in the ears. I think there's a problem here, and that especially talk radio is getting the short end of the stick in terms of actual listeners. What are your thoughts on you must have thoughts on that as a broadcaster and a programmer. What do you think?
Well, I do. And you may remember, I'm sure you do, a number of years ago, Sean Hannity and I did a panel at one of your conventions. Mm-hmm. And we talked about Nielsen's inability to find a digital listener. And we felt it was a detriment to our future and to our format. And we challenged Nielsen to do a better job finding our audience. Here's the dirty little secret that probably Nielsen would rather not talk about. Nielsen is an estimate service, so they're just guessing. They're estimating, based on a tiny little sliver, what your audience really is. But when you talk digital, you're talking actual numbers. I mean, we can track these people right down to where they live and how many minutes they listen, and every one of them gets tracked. It's not a guessing game. So I really think it's a problem for Nielsen. I don't wish anybody ill. But I think that they're not doing a good job finding our listeners, and digitally is the way to find them, and you can find them that way.
I want to add on to that, though, that and maybe you can enlighten me, because I'm not leading you to any conclusion. I truly don't know the answer to this, and maybe you do. I'm not so certain that anyone knows how to get to accurate numbers digitally either, or maybe people don't know how to use it. But you hear claims sometimes that are outrageous, that are just outrageous. And there are so many different ways in which these metrics are assembled and purposed. How accurate or how proficient is our use of digital metrics at this point?
Well, I think it's pretty accurate. Our digital provider is Triton Digital. I think they do a pretty good job tracking these people. And I get a report from them every month. I can see it go up, go down. I can track time spent listening. I can track Qume. I can track what they call session starts. That's how many times did they push the button to listen to you. And this is all data that's coming through the digital provider. And if you know how to read that data, you can get a far-reaching picture of what is happening with your audience.
So it really is a matter of learning how to interpret and knowing what to look for and how to get it. And, of course, having providers that are trustworthy.
Yeah, and I trust mine. And I think the nice thing about the digital number is that it's not a guessing game. It's a real number. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have to wonder how many minutes did they listen. It's just right there on the page.
So what are your thoughts about the future of our culture? I mean, you have your finger on the pulse of popular culture. Politics is popular culture. Politics is a form of entertainment, as is news. The polarization that we're having in this country right now is disturbing. A case could be made that it's always been rough and tumble living in a democracy. And I mentioned earlier that I think the First Amendment and democracy in America is a complex affair and can never be too easy. You know, totalitarian countries are easy. Freedom is not. But, you know, looking ahead for our children and our grandchildren, I mean, if possible, what do you see down the road?
Well, I have good news and bad news. I think the bad news is that we're at a place in America that makes me very uncomfortable. The cancel culture is coming for everybody on the right. And so those of us on the right, or the companies or the shows that are on the right, and let's face it, most of talk radio is on the right, they have something to be fearful of because they would like to silence us. I've never seen it like that before. So that is something to be fearful of. The thing that gives me hope is that there are elements of our society that are fighting back, and that talk radio is going to be the answer to get us out of this mess. I've said this before. I said this in one of your columns that I wrote for you a couple of months ago. I think it was right after the January 6th debacle that was so embarrassing and difficult for the country to deal with. I said, look, talk radio is the way out of the mess that we're currently in, because it's through the free and open expression of ideas that we can figure out which side to be on. I am concerned that the left has taken control of virtually every medium and every opportunity. Now they're getting into corporate boardrooms, they're getting into academia, they're getting all the way down into elementary schools, they're getting into movies, and it's becoming harder to do what we do. But I'm encouraged by the fact that we still are here doing what we do, telling the truth, fighting the fight. And even though, very sadly, we lost Rush Limbaugh as a champion of what we do, others will rise to the forefront and others will take his place. And this battle that we're in is going to be difficult, but we're going to keep fighting it.
And there you have it, an uninterrupted conversation with Phil Boyce, Senior Vice President of Spoken Word Format at the Salem Radio Network. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it, as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you're interested in hearing my weekly 1-hour radio show, The Michael Harrison Rap, check out mhwrap.com. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison, The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a presentation of Podcast One in association with Good Phone Communications and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved.